This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need, from athletic stuff, like a full-court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half-mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace, to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
Welcome to Maximize Your Hunt, the podcast dedicated to those who want the most out of their hunting property. This podcast explores land management, habitat improvement, and hunting strategies that will help you maximize your time in the field. Follow along as industry professionals that live and breathe whitetail deer share their secrets to success. And now, the founder of Whitetail Landscapes, your host, John Teeter.
Hi, I'm John Teeter, Whitetail Landscapes. This is Maximize Your Hunt. Welcome back, everybody. Hopefully everybody's doing well. We're getting a massive snowstorm here in central New York. I am traveling here this week and the week after and the week after that. And that's pretty much my schedule from now on till hunting season. And I wanted to thank everybody for providing those reviews. I had a couple of those I wanted to read off. So those that I do read off, your name or your username here, please reach out to me at John at Whitetail Landscapes, and I will send you a Whitetail Landscapes bumper sticker for your car. First one is from hashtag Bowhunter. Love this podcast. Very knowledgeable and helpful to me. Keep up the great content. Thank you, Bowhunter. Garrett Davis. This is by far my favorite podcast. I really enjoy the level of detail, and I'm constantly implementing ideas I get from the show. Well, hopefully this year, Garrett, we will have more ideas and concepts to introduce to you. My roadshow here, where I'm traveling with clients, I have an introductory report that I go through with every single client. I just revised it, and I'm finalizing it here this week before the next set of clients. And I've got a brand new tool that I'm using to do my drawing and layout. And I also have brand new data sheets that back up all the design philosophies. And we're going to be offering some of those, working on something right now with the food plot architecture design that I think some of this stuff will be free that we're offering. There are a whole bunch of things that we'll be offering, some for free, some will be paid, but it'll be a chance to give you a chance to look at some of the design options that I kind of lay out with clients a little bit more intricately. And like I mentioned previously in other podcasts, we're going to break down some client properties. And of course, I want some of the consultants that are on here to have those options as well. So we'll be talking to different consultants and, you know, maybe sharing some of their secrets and design philosophies around this concept of, you know, building some of the best hunting properties in the U.S. So it's been a while. Rocky Burris is back here on the podcast, SA Farm Management. Excited to have him. I know he recently shot a tremendous deer, as always. He's always killing giant bucks. But, you know, Rocky, of course, is in the details. He's got a lot going on with his kids. He's a busy, busy person, and we're going to try to pull some of his knowledge and experience out this year that we can hopefully employ either throughout the design season or into next hunting season. So let me get him on the line. Rocky, how are you doing?
Hey, man. How's it going?
Good, man. Long time no talk. I know that you sent me a message the other day, and I've been trying to connect with you. And, of course, you know, our schedules, it's always difficult to get on the phone. How you been?
Complaining about how I can't kill a deer. I hadn't had time to hunt, and then pulled off killing a deer before I could get you.
That's good. I know you've been busy with the kids. I know baseball is a big deal for you, and I know that you've been traveling a lot. I've been following you quite a bit, and you just seem busy.
Well, I mean, you know, life kind of gives you it's roller coaster. So, I mean, right now we're in a big travel ball, baseball world. And, my son is really a great player and he loves to play. And so, I mean, I kind of made the decision to start a franchise. So we started Headhunters Baseball and then now this has led into us. I'm in the process right now of building a baseball facility for baseball and softball players. So, it's starting to take over my world. I mean, I don't think you could ever replace the hunting and the thrill, the stuff that I do, for it. But I mean, it's especially since it provides for us, but I mean, we really have, had a lot of our spare time taken up through this baseball world. So some people that know me are like, I was wondering if what's happened to you, but I know what's happened.
Yeah. So. Well, I commend you for putting time and effort into, you know, something like that, as well as, you know, it gives you more time to spend with your family on the road, which is always good and bad. And of course, you know, your son being dedicated. And I think I saw a video of him, I don't know, Christmas Day, out there pitching in the front yard or something like that. And I was like, wow, you love to see kids with that kind of motivation. I mean, it's just, it's awesome. You can't teach that.
No, I mean, he's really had a fire. When he was like 6 years old, he got to where we went to like a regular rec ball, you know, just like what a lot of people, families do, just go to those when they're young. And he was six and he came back crying, saying that he was the only one that could catch and the only one that could throw and he didn't want to play. And I was like, well, I mean, there's other options. We can go to travel ball. That's where the kids that really do it serious are, and they can all catch and throw. And he was all in. So we went and jumped in on an 8-year-old team there, and he just kind of sat there, and I said, you could practice with them and never play this whole season, or you can go play this other and actually get to play games. He wanted to practice. So it was pretty amazing to see that he just wanted to know the game better and be the game. And so it's really kind of, he's just a different, I mean, never, he's always told me he wanted to be a pro baseball player. So, I mean, from at 6 years old, he's told me. So I didn't think there was many 6-year olds saying that. So I was, I'm dedicated to trying to keep him on his path. And he seems to want to outwork everybody and really just try to be the top player at his age every time. So that's where we're at.
That's awesome. And great to hear that about him and you supporting that. And this just goes to show you what kind of parent you are. So kudos to you. I want to talk a little bit about your hunting season. And, you know, I haven't talked to you much during this hunting season. Of course, you know, I've been pretty busy myself, like most people are, you know, trying to focus on what we're designed for. So let's go through a little bit your hunting season. I want to go through some ups and downs. I know time was probably, you know, a factor in all of this. And I want to go into some changes you made on your property and things that seem to be working for you in a positive. So why don't we just kind of run through your hunt season? Let's kind of go through some of your strategy. I mean, you showed some tremendous bucks on camera. I, of course, follow, you know, anybody who's on this, I follow you guys pretty intimately to see how you're doing. And I was impressed with some of the deer that you're showing. You're like, yep, too young. And I'm like, these are giants. I mean, especially in your area. They're young, but I mean, there are some really nice bucks. So I want you to just walk us down your season.
Well, this season's been kind of a weird one. We had a pretty hard drought, and we've got some local issues with road thermals, hunting with thermals at night and spotlighters, which I've even had them hit a farm of mine, and we tried to catch them. I missed them by like 8 minutes. But, I mean, I've got a lot of cameras that, you know, send to me, so you know these things when they happen, right when they happen. And these people are still out there trying to do what they do and claim that they're great hunters by shooting them at night or whatever they're doing. But, so we have that going on in this area. It seems like there's the FBI and multiple, I'm hearing that the FBI and the local sheriff's department is all in on it, trying to catch a ring of guys doing this. So we have that issue going on. So a lot of this year, it seemed like I ran probably 50% less cell cameras than normal, and thought I could just kind of go all in on my key spots. And I feel like I missed a few of the good deer when they were around that I didn't really get their pictures. I might have their pictures, but it won't be on my cells. And I really, really kind of leaned on the cells, which is always a bad thing. But I leaned on the cells this year to tell me when I can hunt, because I was so busy with family and life. And I just really didn't get the photos to tell me, hey, make a sacrifice with your family right now and go jump in the stand and make it happen. In the years past, running twice as many sales, I had multiple chances of that, and I took advantage of, you know, half of those chances, and I could pull it off. They were, you know, a lot of times the sales helped me with a confirmation that he's home. And you know, it really has to do with how good you are at putting cameras in certain areas at certain times of year. And I know my buddies, there's a couple buddies of mine that are on my cell cameras, and they'll be like, dude, you were out at 12:30 at night. What are you doing? And I was like, man, the next 2 weeks is going to be, I need to move all my cells to a different spot, and they need to be taking pictures of this. And he was like, I mean, I'm not moving any miles. I was like, well, you just watch. And he'd be like, oh my gosh. But, you know, there's certain times of year that, and I'm sure on here you've talked about, you know, like the preseason, those mock scrapes and stuff. I mean, they get hammered hard. But then when we get a big major cold front jump running in here, and for us, I mean, when it gets down to 20 degrees or, and it has some precipitation and stuff, I'm in West Tennessee. So you get that kind of weather, it's pretty extreme, and the deer kind of shift to the food and stuff, and they kind of focus on that for that period of time. So anywhere I'm really looking for a mature deer that I know that, in years past of data collection and stuff off of cameras, I'll run the cameras and jump out there and stick them in the fields for a couple weeks and see if he hit the field at night, you know, and then it lets me know if he's there because of the cold front and stuff. So, I mean, a lot of times, you know, I don't have the time to spend in the stand like I would normally want to, because I have four kids and they're all in sports and they're all, and we homeschool and my wife works, and it's just a mess for me to have time. So, I just try to use the cameras to kind of spend some time in the stand with them, doing my hunting work. And then when they catch somebody, especially at night or, you know, it's all due to timing. It's not just because I got a picture of him. I know I can go get him. It has a lot to do with when I think he'll hit daylight. And if he is in the area and the weather tells me he's going to daylight, I'll go. And you know, that might take one or two sits, but usually I'll get a chance at him. So this year it just didn't work out. I didn't really have the weather that I needed. I didn't have the pictures that I needed, and seemed to be where I was on my spare days that my wife was home and I could have gone. I was working 2.5 hours away from the house. So that was no option to check out an hour or two early and jump in the stand. So it was kind of a rough year. I feel like I missed the rut. I missed the pre-rut, and all I've got is about a week left. And I was literally digging holes for this facility, sitting on top of a dingo with it running full throttle and 500 yards, that big deer that you're talking about that I shot just a couple of days ago. He came out into my clover field, and I was hunting off of a dingo, because I'm always prepared. You know, I'm always prepared. I got my rifle in the truck and binoculars, so I left it running and idling high. And I took off running the truck and see how big he was, because I knew it was like 30 minutes before dark. And, you know, I wasn't planning on it happening, but I saw how big he was, and I was like, he raised his head, and I said, it could be one of two deer. And like one of them, I passed this deer, the one I actually shot. I did pass him like 6 days ago, and I had good daylight and good time to see him and watch him. And I knew who he was. I knew he was 4-year-old deer, but you know, I've really pushed myself hard to, push for shooting 5 and 6-year-old deer. And it's mainly because my wall is full and my wife really doesn't care to see another one. So, and if I want to fight that battle, I need to shoot one of the best, you know, one of the biggest, best deer in the area and, you know, top 5% deer. And that four-year-old, I mean, he was up there. I mean, he's probably top 10% or something deer, but you know, I really thought it was his daddy. And, I had his picture, the one that I harvested, behind my house, eating in the clover field, just 2 days earlier, and it was 70 degrees, you know, so we had crazy weather for December the 28th or whatever it was. I shot him 70 degrees. I'm out there in a t-shirt, you know, so it was wild to see that he came out and he was by himself. Usually I'm working out there on the tractor and stuff, trying to get the grade right. And I was seeing 8 and 10 does come out and eating the beans and just look at me every once in a while. I mean, they just had, like, I have no pressure on my property because I try not to allow deer to know that they're being hunted. So by design, and deer just, you know, if it's some constant machinery or something like that, they don't put two and two together. I don't honestly don't think deer are smart enough to know that we drive trucks at night and we drive vehicles and tractors and, you know, I don't really think that they're thinking we're going to run them down and hunt them with that. So, survivalists they are. And, you know, I feel like they know that that's going on. They check in on it to make sure something weird doesn't happen. But other than that, they kind of kept their same pattern. I was seeing those deer every night, and a couple small bucks would show up right before dark. But it being so hot, I didn't feel a big deer would ever show. So I was working till dark. But I was always looking, and I was always prepared in case he did. So He happened to. It was like the day before the front came, so maybe he felt the front coming and was trying to get a good feed on that clover. Because I mean, seems to be the clover has been a big pull right now, especially with the heat. So all that moisture in the clover and stuff, they're really, and it was trying to grow. I mean, we had warm temperatures for a week, so I actually saw my wheat grow taller, my turnips get bigger. I mean, I've seen everything try to wake up. I've seen some, even my blueberries have tried to start growing. So, but they're going to get hit, I'm sure.
That's some crazy weather conditions that you're having, you know?
I know. It's pretty wild. Pretty wild.
I want to go back to something, and I like your readiness, and you've got your gun available to you at any time, because that stuff happens. You know, my opening day gun season story is a little crazy. I'll share it with you. So we had helped one of the guys that we hunt with locally and on this farm that a bunch of us are on together. And it's a little bit of an okay corral kind of thing. Like, you know, everybody and their brother, and you know, you don't know what guys are doing and there's no strategy. And so, but I've got my fixed spots and people kind of know, you know, where I'm hunting and in concert with where they are. And so we've got it kind of planned out. Well, my shooter buck, I expected him to show up in one of these areas in the morning. So I thought I had a 50-50 shot at him. Opening any guns, it's just a gamble. And, but it's, you know, after that, things really go dark around here. That just the volume of pressure. So, and this is again, highly pressured farm. And there's, you know, there's about 20, I don't know how many, I would say for every 20 acres, there's about one hunter on average. So you can kind of get the average of like that volume of pressure. So there's a lot of individuals hunting. Long story short, I got kind of a tip from one of the guys I was hunting with that somebody thought they saw my deer. Well, anyhow, I spotted the deer and I had to crawl up to him. I don't know, it was about 300 yards away, and I snuck up to this deer. And when I shot him, he jumped up and he was laying down. He jumped up and he, you know, like a bull with his head down. And he came right at me. Like, I had to like run backwards and shoot him again. And it was kind of like Dances with Wolves, where the buffalo or bison kind of like sprawls out on the ground in front of the hunter. It was like one of those hunts. And my son looked over at me like, holy God, what the hell? Yeah. But the story there is, it was place and time. It's always place and time sometimes. And the reason I share that is it sounds similar. Like, you're doing something, whether you're trying or intending to hunt or not, but you're in the right place. And sometimes that is hunting. And that didn't take away from that deer. It didn't take away from the experience. It just kind of added to it. It was another dimension of, you know, the strategy. So I have a question out of this. And, you know, some of this has to do with deer daylighting more. And you've mentioned this many times on this podcast. And you also mentioned that you don't really go into areas. I know that you had some significant disturbance on your property. You did some logging a year or so ago, and you were doing some design layout, and you know, you've got a whole bunch of other farms to hunt, and you know, it just happens to be you've got property, you know, adjacent to your house. What have you seen, and what activity has kind of sparked this increase in daylight activity? I mean, have you seen an increase based on your strategy? And what are some of the things the listeners can do to increase their daylight activity on their property?
Well, I mean, I know that my access has everything to do to it, in my opinion. The more my deer feel like they're not hunted, the more they daylight. I mean, it's just common sense. Like I mean, they've gone their whole season and never blown by human scent. And then there's no way that they could feel like they're being pursued outside of the normal habitat animals, you know, the normal predator population. So, I mean, I will say that I have transformed my farm a lot this year because we did do the timber project and we did cut our timber, for anybody that doesn't know. I mean, I cut my timber, a year ago, I guess, and it had a good bit of growth. I would say a lot of growth, I guess. And it's really gotten attracted, like a lot of my big deer are all over my farm and very random. And I'm just like, golly, this is, not typical. Like this year it was kind of a struggle. Like my biggest deer, I hope he's still alive. I mean, he was a couple weeks ago, he just hung out in my food plot and then I've never seen him again, but I have 155 acre farm, 75 acres on one side of the road, 75 on the other. Well, they cut all of it select, and in some areas I had hard select, some areas I had light select, some areas we said don't cut. So we have different habitats throughout. Some areas are thicker, some are not. But what it's done, it's created a lot larger scale bedding scenario. And it's really kept my deer in that scenario more than I expected. I haven't had a chance. It's not due to me, but my logger decided he's not going to show up anymore and he's not going to come clean my roads and not going to come do all the things he said he was going to do on contract. So who knows if that's going to be a logger expense or not. But anyway, I haven't got my road system in. I don't have any of my strategic food plots throughout the timber project. So all that part of the development plan has not happened. And with that not being done, I didn't really have access to get in there and hunt those animals without feeling like at any step I could have stepped near a bed. So I stayed out, and I still haven't. I've walked through it one day, and I saw it was intertwined with bedding everywhere and tons of trails and buck rubs and signs, and I was like, dude, they're all in here. So I literally walked it one day when I thought it was just a really tough, real kind of windy. I didn't feel like anything was going to see me and understand what was going on. I just slipped through it one day, and I realized real quick that this is why I don't have, because everything was developed around my food sources before, and the timber stand was fairly mature, not real mature, but it was fairly mature enough that they would bed in it sporadically in the little thickets and stuff, but they would travel it mostly. Well, now it's almost like 150 acres of bedding and 20 acres of my habitat. And so I've got a new strategy, and it's going to be a great project to show what you can do and how you can transform a season of here's seven shooters that are all good and mature that just sporadically would hit your plots and most of the time were gone to actually having some kind of a system where you can dictate where they're going and what they're doing and how to hunt them. So right now I'm just kind of hunting the edges, staying off of them just like I've always done, and felt like I could pick one or two of them out. And I did pick one, and it just happened to be the 4-year-old, but I felt like it was the 6-year-old that I knew of, but it just wasn't. And to add to the twist, one whole side of the farm, it's got three sides of it that's getting cut into a solar farm. And they're completely erased 700 acres of timber and putting all solar.
Yeah, you kind of went.
I'm gonna have like a.
Yeah, you kind of went digital, but you said you have a solar farm on the other side. You said,
yeah, on the other side of my property, they've done three sides of my 75 acres. It's going to be basically a high fence solar farm. We raised 700 acres of habitat and put solar farm there. So. You know, there's a lot of animals displaced where we've got probably double or triple the raccoons. We've got, it's given us a one heck of a project to think about. And, you know, and I'm sure I'm going to attract some, cause I had my timber cut and the bedding's improved. I'm sure I attracted some deer that I never would have had and that are looking for, you know, a new home, different things like that. So it's just kind of a learning project right now with all that going on at one time.
Now, I remember you mentioning this before, and I think some of the takeaways, and we're going to get to follow this over time, is, you know, how you deal with, like you said, predators or just you know, now the lack of connection, it's fragmented. So the property is now somewhat isolated. And what does that do to deer movement? And how does it push deer or move deer, displace deer, because you don't have quality habitat surrounding the property, or maybe a lesser quality habitat, and that drives those deer to your property specifically, but it spreads out the animals a little bit more. So I guess, you know, I'm interested to follow this, but I want to go back to something. And I think this is kind of like a first principles example where you go in and, you know, whether the logger, you know, did his job or not, but they removed trees, and everyone thinks that's the answer. And that's part of the equation. That's a part of the equation. You mentioned that there's randomness in their movement. It's not consistent. It's not laid out like precisely. And you've got a project coming up, right, where you're going to dial it more. You're going to make it more sequential in movement, or maybe serial in movement, where deer are going from, you know, very specific areas, and you're controlling the movement, whether it's food or a form of cover or pinches. Maybe talk a little bit about your strategy around taking now, you know, in a property that has been, we'll just say, logged somewhat erratically. There is some cover. Obviously, there's probably some tops laying across the landscape, but you're now going to transform it. Maybe walk us through some of the things you're thinking about that's going to fix some of the issues you mentioned about inconsistent movement.
Well, the biggest thing is, like, I don't feel comfortable the way it sits. I mean, the land, you know as well as I do, I mean, habitat is always improving or declining. I mean, it's never going to stay the same. So your habitat's always changing. And in itself, I know if I just leave it alone, you could try to figure it out. You could try to figure out how they're using it, how they're taking in all the changes and utilizing it and using that from cover to cover, and which is better cover than other. But it's a great opportunity to come in and really just dictate those movements for myself and for my access. So I think that's where it's really important. Like, if you were to have this on your own project, having somebody that actually understands how to control movement and how to tell deer what to do without sounding like you're all powerful. But I mean, really, there are some great techniques, and I tried to do it through the loggers in the beginning process. Transitions from where I told them to cut heavy and where I told them they could just cut and where I told them not to cut. Those transition spots were thicker than expected. They were thick, just as thick as some of the areas they cut hard. Well, when that just created a scenario where they could just be anywhere. In my opinion, I didn't like that, because I like to know when I access something and I leave, I've been bulletproof. I like to bulletproof my sets. So now I'm going to go in and, you know, create road systems from really thick areas to really not thick areas, and maybe burn out and keep an area cleaner than another area, especially if I'm going to access through it or something, so that deer will travel through it, but not necessarily bed in it, especially when there's more desirable bedding, you know, 5-star hotels over here, and this is all 2-star. They're going to go, you know, especially mature deer, they're going to go to where it's the best. So, and they're going to claim it. So, and you got to kind of create, you know, if I've got 5 shooters on that big of a property, I mean, it's not really a big property. It's a small property, but if you want to separate and do all that, try to separate those bigger deer, have those doe families separated some, so that you create that movement throughout the property where bucks are checking from doe group to doe group, you know. And I'm kind of against the whole, you know, thinning your herd and doing all the stuff that you hear a lot of people talk about, because I really learned to, you know, keep up with my girls and keep up with my does and doe groups and really take care of them and make them raise their kids on me and all that stuff, because I love to see deer. And when you do that, though, you kind of end up knowing exactly when those girls are in heat. They're always within that 24-hour span of when they were last year and stuff like that. So you kind of understand which areas become hot spots and which areas might be 2 days away from being a hot spot. And that kind of gives you an option to move your move your hunting set instead of just going and hunting and hoping. So a lot of mine's very strategic, I use cameras to collect data. I always talk about cameras, and I feel like they do twice as much work as I do. And that's why my deer daylight more, because I feel like they're always out there collecting the data. Yeah. Maybe I'm hunting with them, the cameras, for next year, but at least next year, my schedule, like we've talked before, I set my schedule for next year, and I already know a lot of the areas that deer had frequented the year before, and those that were getting chased over here on this date, and those were getting chased over here on that date. And sometimes that can give me almost up to 2 weeks already planned out of hunting. And if the weather ever hits those dates, I'm going. You know, I play that card. I don't need the photos to tell me to go or anything like that. So that's where I'm at with the project here is I got to go get those road systems in. I got to go get my access done first. And then once I've built the access, all right, what areas am I compromised? I want to make sure that those are not great bedding scenario areas. And whatever I need to do, if I need to remove the tops, if I need to run a fire through there and burn the tops down to where it's more, you know, is whatever I need to do. If I need to screen it better, I'm got to do it. And because like I've said before, I mean, I feel like access is key. And if you can get in and you can get out with deer all in your plots or all bedded all around you, and you can still get out of there. I mean, that's exactly why some of these guys are killing monsters in the cities and stuff, because the deer are okay with things that they don't feel threatened by. So, I mean, if your access is in and out, it's never felt threat, they're going to be okay with anything. Even if it's right beside your own house you live in, if you get outside of your boundaries and get in the woods and your scent gets in there, that changes things. And I know it for a fact. I mean, we're getting the solar farm done all the way around that property where I just killed that deer. And I mean, they're running I could see bulldozers and everything driving around in the background. What, you know, through the woods, you can look through the timber. 75 acres isn't very big. So you can look through the timber and you can see these things and people walking all over and in their orange uniforms and, you know, just doing all kinds of dirt work and everything else. And I'm just steady watching deer walk out and eat in my food plot. They've been bedding right beside all that all day long. Yeah. Cause they know that's not a, you know, they've been watching those people work all day. It's crazy.
Let me try to get pretty specific on your property. And I like two things here. You mentioned your kind of access first and your designs, you know, before you kind of finalize the habitat features that are going to amplify deer interests, you're focused on your entry and exit routes to those stand locations or even work locations. Cause you said, you know, starting with roads. And, you know, patternable travel is probably one of the most important aspects of design, getting deer to go certain locations kind of in a design step format. And again, like you said earlier, like there is no, you know, puppeteering of every movement of an animal, but deer do go and you can control them, you know, pretty consistently. Now, I guess in my designs, one of my secrets is looking specifically at each individual area and assigning a shape. And it's a specific design philosophy. It's I have a patternable shape that I apply to an area. And whether it's to change the microclimate so it's warmer or colder in an area, or to change air or wind flow in a particular area, you know, those type of strategies, just increase food availability, focusing on biodiversity. The combination thereof gives me kind of a format to look at. Now, when you could start to drill in and want to create these areas that deer are going to frequent, and, you know, a bedding area could be a bedding area, a loafing area, an activity area, you know, just in general, they're going to, you know, use those areas at a high rate. What are some of the things you're looking for from a size and shape standpoint on your particular property? You know, are they several acres? Are they 5 acres? Are they a quarter acre? Do they vary? Are there some factors there? And then what are the aspects of design? I mean, you're in a warmer climate. Are there aspects of, you know, are you going to put, you know, water resources or ponds or, you know, anything for an animal to be more comforted in those particular areas that keep the holding power of them staying in those areas much longer. What's your thought on size and then individual strategy in these in particular bedding areas that allow you to hold deer?
The best thing that I can say is, like, I always try to focus on what I think a mature deer would do. And a lot of times, like, he's much like us. I mean, it'd be simple for me to know where a big deer would want to bed, because I mean, he's going to be like me. He's going to want to get on a point, if there's any kind of terrain feature that gives you better visibility throughout the property, that's probably where he's going to want to be. He's going to desire to be able to see as much as he can see and smell the rest. And if you can find locations like that, a lot of times people throw stands up right there. And I look at it like, if I can sit right here, can I get a stand right here in and out and make it where he doesn't want to be right here and he can be somewhere else?
How many discounts does USAA Auto Insurance offer? Too many to say here. Multi-vehicle discount, safe driver discount, new vehicle discount, storage discount, legacy.
How many discounts will you stack up? Tap the banner or visit usaa.com/autodiscounts. Restrictions apply.
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
In that same area, then I'll maybe take it over for me and try to make it undesirable. But in most cases, I try to pinpoint those areas that, man, look at the view right here. Look at this. And it's all thick and couple more tops right here and do this and he'll be here for sure. And then, but he can see all this and all that. So I can't even possibly access or come through any of that area. So we start building small micro bedding areas and stuff like that for the does in those areas. And so he can kind of oversee them and stay more. And then you find your access, and then you try to build food source, water, of course. I mean, we are in the warm, so every water hole that I've ever dug in this area, I mean, I dig them in my food plots, I dig them, they're going to hit them. You can put tanks in the ground, you can do whatever you want. You can put, if you're worried about, because it is warmer here a lot, some people get, you know, algae or whatever gets in their tank. You throw a couple copper, you know, copper fittings in the tank and nothing will grow in it. And it'll be just fine and the deer eat it, drink out of it all the time. A lot of times I'll, you know, try to make it where the land will refill it every time it rains. So do some, you know, make sure you know where you're putting your tank, not just in a flat spot, but maybe where water drainage will go through your tank and flush it and keep it fresh. But we do all that. I mean, and I do it within the bedding sometimes, so I can run a camera and see who's bedding. And as I get up to go get water, I can know that he's bedded there. I mean, if I get a picture of him at 12 o'clock noon, he's laying there. He's within that bedding. And if I've got a food source really close to there, that's even a half acre little food source, food plot, I'm going to hunt it because I know he's laying right there. He's in the trap. But in my opinion, that's what I've always called buck trap. I build those to, you know, basically a scenario where when he's in that system, you pretty much know where he should go. And it really makes, you know, makes it a lot easier to predict when you're going to get one. That kind of stuff, I don't really think that it's, you got to go get an earth mover and go change a bunch of stuff. I think you just have to kind of be able to read the terrain and read the habitat that you have. And then that's why I wanted to let it sit for a year, is because I wanted one season pass so I could go in there and make sure I didn't waste any time doing something that they were already going to do, you know. So I wanted to go in and see the areas that they really like the way they are now. And then how can I improve these areas to attract more, and to how can I control the movement in and out of these areas, and how can I access to hunt these areas and not get caught. And so a lot of that's just being a hunter, being somebody that knows how to plan and build plans, and but then being a hunter and going reading the habitat, reading what the wildlife's already doing, and understanding, well, if I do this, it's going to erase this. And if I do that, it's going to attract this. So, and that's why I think, once again, I think that's why it's so important that guys like us get hired. I mean, if you just go in there and randomly do stuff because it looks good to you and you don't really understand how to read what's really going on, I mean, I feel like you waste so much. You could really just erase what you had, or you might go in there and get lucky and build something special. I mean, it's just a risk to spend that kind of time and money when we're all stressed for time. So, go ahead.
This brings up an interesting point. I talked to a client, one of my next clients here, he's in New York, and he said, you know, I think I messed things up, you know, 10, whatever it was, years ago. Jim Brouker, who's a guy up in Michigan, suggested that they, you know, basically hinge cut every tree they possibly could. And I don't think he consulted on this particular client's property, but he provided, you know, that general recommendation, and people ran with that as like, I must do this, or I shall do this. And at the quantity and scale that people were doing that, they ended up just destroying their interesting, well, they destroyed the quality habitat because they overcut. They created inaccessibility or accessibility issues. You mentioned something a second ago that just triggered me to say, hey, you know, when you're coming up with your design philosophy and you have these in-bed kind of scenarios where deer are spending a lot of times in the area, it's controlling their movement in and out, no different from controlling your movement in and out of an area, and understanding what deer naturally want to do. And what I really kind of enjoyed what you mentioned is I waited a year before I made a decision. I do the same exact thing. I'll make an improvement and I'll sit on it a year and see what happens. And I won't over apply myself. Like I have a new smaller property. It's 18 acres. I will not over apply a strategy until I see what exactly occurred. I noticed one of the deer came out of this one area, and then I just followed up and started paying attention to why these deer are using this particular area. And I saw, hey, they're bedding on my neighbor's property. So the worst thing I could possibly do in this example with this client is go in and cut off an area where there's a high interest or funneling opportunity coming from that particular area, which is usually a great camera location. And why would I want to eliminate activity assuming that I'm benefiting from it because either I have good resident cover and food source and I'm just stacking deer at a layer interior, further interior, where that allows that deer to feel more of that sanctum effect. I want to get back to a question that I wanted to ask you, and I mentioned it a second ago, was I know that this might be hard to kind of, you know, dial in, but you've got a large area, 75 acres, and I don't know what the demographic of field and old field and agriculture and timber and shrubland and all that is, but when we're talking bedding, specifically bedding, when you look at your property in a sanctum, like, you know, sanctuary area, generally, I know that you probably have, what you mentioned, you went in to just take a look at it, right? But you generally have like, hey, I'm not going to put too much intrusion on this property. Are the size of these bedding areas as big as the areas that you're not intruding in? Meaning, like, every area that you're not actually hunting, are you going to consider it a bedding area, likely have it as a bedding area in your design? So basically your entire sanctuary is essentially a bedding area and you're essentially using food sources or food plot trails to create corral and move deer. And you're kind of looking at that from that perspective, or do you have a totally different mindset when you're doing layout in these particular areas? I know some of this is seasonal, right? If my area, you know, shrubland thickets are used at an all time high during this period, or, you know, areas that are water rich are used at an all time high in this particular period, but I still don't necessarily intrude on those areas, but I know how to move cameras and take data and also visualize and understand how deer are using areas so I can get intel. Maybe I can make a hunting decision, those type of things. So I'm interested, is an entire sanctuary basically the definition of a bedding area for you at this point? And you're obviously doing all that work up to building these great areas, and then you're just walking away until next season where you got to improve them, you know, to make that, you know, refined activity work just to your, you know, precision hunting.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if we're not talking about a client's property, we're just talking about my property.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, my properties, I would say yes. I would say that basically I will visit the areas I don't hunt twice a year, three times a year, make sure those paths are still clear to access the way I want to hunt. Like, I mean, it kind of doesn't make sense to not check them. I'm going to go all in to hunt this location and this food source and expecting deer to come out in these areas. And I never go check and make sure a big tree didn't fall across that or didn't, you know what I mean? So I kind of go in and I make sure that the habitat has stayed the same or gotten a little bit better. Or once I start seeing, okay, man, this stuff's starting to mature to the point where things are thinning out in here, and this is going to all start changing unless I do something. So a lot of that I do consider it all a sanctuary. A guy called me today that I built a plan for, and he was like, I wanted to touch base, and it's been over a year. You know, he's really been focusing on the area that I designed, and which was kind of the core of his property. And he has timber on two sides of his property. And in the middle, there's like some little timber, but it's very designable, very huntable. And the timber blocks were very unhuntable, in my opinion, because he had them cut and they were all unified and they were kind of like, I just didn't know, like, you go in there, you're going to spook somebody. Like, they're gonna know you're coming in. Their access was not great, and it's just they have the advantage to them. So I didn't really design much in those areas. I just put like a burn rotation and do whatever we can to maintain the habitat, and then, you know, throw cameras in to monitor if there is a deer that's desirable. In the future, we go in and we try to design to kill that deer instead of create a scenario where you're in there more than you should be because it's huntable in your eyes, but it's really not. So I don't normally try to put myself in areas that I just don't feel super comfortable. I hope that's making sense, but I leave that for the deer. I leave that for them to thrive in and live and feel safe and run around and never smell a single footstep. And when they do that, it's made great scenarios for me because I'm not able to hunt as much as I prefer. So I always use the weather fronts and different things like that to trigger my movement, because I know that expands those movements and that expands those ranges that day and during the daylight. And when it does, it expands it right into my scenario, and I get my shot. So a lot of that, those normal days, yeah, sure, I can go slip into those what you call sanctuaries or bedding area scenarios, and a lot of that has both. That has bedding, that has transitions, that has it has it all. It's not, you know, I still consider all that sanctuary. And I'm not saying I don't hunt in the woods, but I don't really hunt in the woods. Yeah. I don't get in there very much unless it's all a timber block. Now, if I get in there, I try to figure out how I use creeks and rivers. I mean, I hunt like in Nebraska. I mean, we have a ranch up there that we hunt, and it's, you know, it's creeks and rivers, and it's just like water's moving. So I basically sit on the edge of that creek and let it pull my scent down the river. I'm just a big freak about not know I'm there. And I can use the river to slip in, and I can get up and I can get in I can put a pop-up tent right on the river, and it basically sucks my scent straight out the back door, and it runs down the river, and deer can use that river bottom. And it's, you know, that's not food plots. It's not anything. And I shoot a 150 or 140 or 160 every single year with a bow, and I can do it within 3 days. And it's just, but it's because I can go, I know I have found the way it works in that bottom.
Yeah.
And I used to outfit in there and we used to hang ladder stands, and we used to do all this in that bottom, and we could not get those deer. We put feeders out because it was legal. I mean, we could hunt over a feeder. We could hunt. We could not kill them. And then when my partner and I split, I ended up keeping that ranch. Well, I started doing things I wanted to do. And well, I didn't put feeders out. I didn't do all that stuff. I didn't want to spend all that money. I was like, the deer are here. All I got to do is know how to hunt them. So I'd go in there and I messed around and got not close enough to the river and they'd catch me some. And then I found out I'm sitting on the bank and I literally just do it off of pop up in a chair and I can kill one every single year, every time I sit it. Sometimes we kill two or three shooters out of that in 1 week. And it's just such a bulletproof set that you could hunt it every single day, morning and evening, as long as you're use the river, the noise of the river to access. They don't hear you. They hear the water rushing. They can't hear you. They can be sitting in front of the box stand. It's not even a box stand. It's just a tent. But they can be 50 yards in front of it. And I've seen them in binoculars in the moonlight. And I just stand on the side of the river and let it get light until they leave because it's not desirable. And then I'll crawl on my hands and knees and get in there with a bow. I mean, it is that good of a set. And that's what I'd like. So when I hunt the woods, I try to use those types in there, like anywhere that a bluff, say there's a big washout or something, you know, there's all kinds of things in the woods that, if you have a giant creek, like my property has a big creek, 20-foot drop off. Well, I mean, you know, if your scent's blowing to the creek, the only thing that's going to know is anybody on the other side of the creek kind of. So, I mean, you got a good, you know, nothing's going to sneak in from behind you or something. So it kind of gives you an access or a place for your wind to go and different things like that. But, I do take and really anywhere deer like to bed, I try to create scenarios where I'm hunting in between two beds, preferably, two big bedding scenarios. And then I'll have a little, if I can produce food source there, I don't care if it's an eighth acre. If I can produce a little bit of a staging area, that'll be like a bedding area set. And I have staging between two big bedding areas. And if I can figure out my access to get in there, I mean, I know he's in trouble if he's there. So that's kind of that's just the way I hunt. Now with clients, you know, it's kind of different because you don't want to take them out of the season. I take myself out of the season. I just go in to, like I've told you, I go in to kill. I don't really go in to hunt. So, if you go in to hunt and you want to see deer a lot and you still want to be there when he kills it, but you got to be really careful because you can't, you know, you got to produce sets that are able to hunt a bunch, but not ruin it. I think a lot of daylight movement stuff gets changed on a lot of people because they overhunt when it's too early because they're anxious. And then when it's right, they've already stunk it up, you know, and they kind of lose their chances. So, hunting less, kill. I always have been able to harvest more by far.
Yeah, no, this is good. And I think some of the examples there are good. I like the jump in strategy, but having a plan prior to. And like, you don't have to necessarily have these. And I know you and I are both big on box blinds, but you know, you don't necessarily have to have box blinds strategically be your only option. You can have other options. And I stress that with clients is if. And my partner does as well. If you have an opportunity to go make a move, make the move. And because, you know, once you're out of there and you let things rest, you're likely to increase that level of attraction. And it's not so obscure to be like, hey, you know, I think I should hunt this, you know, once in a great while. It's the consistency of people going in and out. And I see that so much with a lot of the clients. I mean, I bet you, I know this is a crazy figure to throw out, but I bet you 90% of the client properties that I've been on, most of the tree stands are in bedding areas and high use bedding areas, meaning I don't even need to find the bedding area necessarily. I just need to locate all the tree stands and mark them and say, okay, these are likely bedding areas because people hunt sign. They don't understand that flow and movement is all element of design. And that's all an element of a hunting technique where, you know, you can have these high use rate areas that are connecting, you said, you know, one particular area to the next, kind of in a dumbbell shape, and inserting yourself in that equation in some capacity to kill a deer that transitions through those areas. But there's areas where deer are going to loaf and rest. And what I was trying to get earlier is, you know, I was looking at my property today. I had to go over and spread. I didn't have to. I decided to spread some forbs all in this particular area that I burned. I burned a couple areas, and so it's just black dirt. And, you know, a great time to, before a snowstorm, is to get that seed down on the ground. Anyhow, long story short, I was over there and I'm looking at my layout and I can peek over the edges and I have, you know, a 220 foot elevation drop in one section and I can just, you know, there's bedding in terraces and I can see down and I'm just like, man, you know, if I could seclude these areas a little bit better and I did some things differently, you know, 8 or 9 years ago, I could really hold more deer in these particular areas. And what that makes me realize is, you know, as the vegetation starts to deplete, and you get bare sticks and the frequency of use starts to go down because the stem density is not there to, and again, I have a north facing slope. There's a lot of factors working against me, but I have good soil fertility. It really requires a pretty stringent eye and plan and layout. And I really had to learn all this through my mistakes, but some of these areas that are, you know, high use areas for bedding or resting or loafing purposes, traditionally to me are sometimes too high of a risk to hunt. And I think you have to know your level of sophistication and awareness to get in those areas so you're not bumping deer and creating a bigger issue by, you know, basically ejecting deer off your property and having that awareness factor before you make a strategic decision, because it's not strategic if the end result is failure. And, you know, I'm not trying to put pressure on everybody to think my way, but, you know, I have a real kind of, you know, ideal strategy. And I've, again, I'm not even close to carrying capacity. So I have a low set of eyes looking around the property. And then my issue now is, you know, when I build these hunting properties, I get a swamping effect where, and you're going to experience this issue. So I'm interested to see what happens, where the deer are displaced to your property. So they reside on your property at a high rate. And that upsets your balance of food and cover resources. And a lot of times that can displace deer just based on pure numbers. And they are not used to or tolerate that social activity when they've had so much space. And I think you're going to potentially run into maybe a bit of a conundrum on what to do next, because I think the solar project, you know, might be the end result of the solar project. And I don't know for sure, but, you know, deer can disperse all over the place. But if you've got high value resources and you've done all this work, I mean, you're likely going to, like you said earlier, attract some deer that maybe originally weren't there, but as well as you're going to add more deer to the equation, which may be exceeding your carry capacity and may push deer to not be as resident. And who knows what that does to, you know, good deer like good areas, but who knows what that does to maybe stacking more deer in a particular property. But again, I've seen instances where deer are okay with the social dynamic such that, you know, they tolerate. Bucks specifically, I've noticed, tolerate that social dynamic a lot different from does, where, you know, I don't know if it's a pecking order. You can probably do some a human equation of this, but, you know, women have a tendency, I've noticed more time, and I don't know what the right term of this other than saying bitchy, but they have a tendency to not necessarily accept other women at the same rate men might. And that's an analogy that I think applies a lot of time to some of these deer. And I'm not trying to humanize it, because I know it's not exactly a one-to-one relationship, and it's unique to every individual and you know, what they are considering and what they accept. But I know that there's factors in all of this, and, you know, you can build the best security cover whatsoever, but if you've got a doe or a buck that, you know, that we hear these bully bucks or dominant does, alpha does that displace deer because of their behavior, that's a deer to target. And I've been very adamant about telling people, like, you want deer that have a good social accolade where they're good being around other deer. And, you know, that doesn't create this, I want to just say environment that's not hospitable. You want a hospitable environment. And what that means, and I think, you know, guys like been on this podcast, Don Higgins, he's created that environment, and that's why he's holding 60 deer on 120 acres. And, you know, that's way beyond most people's carrying capacity, but the volume of food around his property deliberately promotes that. And the deer that stick around, they have a choice, and they can choose to move off if they don't agree with the temperament of other deer on the property. And that's a long way about saying that there's a social dynamic that we'll never understand from an individual standpoint, but we can start to categorize it and maybe humanize it a little bit so it starts to make sense to you and me. And I don't know, I figured I'd just add a bit to the conversation, Rocky.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% because I know that I would say probably, I don't know, maybe closer to 60 or 70% of the deer that utilized my 75 came from that solar farm area. They would bed there. They would, because it was a pine plantation. So they had a lot of growth, a lot of, you know, medium age pines, wasn't super open. It was, I mean, a lot of the deer did go there. So I'm kind of noticing the bucks are using, there's more pines across the road. It seems like they moved from that pine plantation to the next, and there was a lot of fields that I don't normally see deer in the evening. Now I'm seeing deer in. So it's kind of, you know, I know that it's happening. I know that displacement of those deer, they're kind of spreading around, and some are buzzing through, some are staying. Most of them seem to be just buzzing through. Cause I mean, we pick up a random deer every once in a while on camera and we're like, well, who was that? Where did that deer come from? And you know, he wouldn't be there the rest of the season. So yeah. You just kind of, you don't know. I mean, it's kind of a learning curve. Yep. As far as who's going to come and stay. But our habitat being cut and the timber being cut a year ago, I mean, that all changed everything in a more attractive way. So I'm hoping that we don't lose everybody, that we end up keeping at least half of what we had going on. That way, maybe, you know, in your eyes, maybe we attract more than that. But I think that, being this close to the noise and all that, I think a lot of them just left. I mean, I don't know if they'll come back. I guess they will. But I think a lot of them just took off and don't know what they're doing.
It'll be a good story to figure out what ends up happening and what you see. And if you have to change your hunting strategy or your deer management strategy for that matter. And maybe you don't, maybe the deer that are occupying the space that they currently have on the landscape are kind of creating a stronghold. And I think that's quite possible because, you know, like us, I mean, once you create a great familiarity with something, a lot of people have a hard time changing. And that really applies a lot to deer and some of the dynamics here. I've worked with some property managers where I work with, I don't know, all over the place, high deer populations, low deer populations, a strategy for each. I've changed, you know, some of the, I want to say the cadence of movement where there's been general migrations of movement to areas where deer are just displaced because of different weather factors. Even on my own property, you know, it's a north facing slope right now. You know, it's blistery, it's cold. I mean, it's taking a direct hit from where it's positioned to almost every northwest storm, which case in point today. And I was over there and I'm kicking up deer left and right. And yeah, they're even willing to sustain those weather conditions because the quality of habitat is so great. But again, I told you earlier, like if I could make some changes to that property and put more emphasis in conifer layouts and strategic locations and just kind of buffering some of these storm systems, my goodness, would I be in a better situation. But again, I still don't remedy it because I got 50 other projects going on you know how it is, you know?
I do. That's for sure. Well, we're getting, you do good having north facing slope. You do. It sounds like you're doing a good job.
Well, it takes time. Yeah. Well, let's say we're at the end of this. We've been an hour over. I know that's been a while since we caught up, and you know, I appreciate you taking time. We've got to get you more on this podcast, and I've said that to you more and more. We've got to get you more on here just to talk about. I really like your project specifically because you're so intimate with it. And it's a lot different sometimes, unless you're actually working on a client, you know, that like where you really are making the best decisions for either your hunting style, like you said, other people, your buddies, I mean, kids, you know, the whole gamut, right? Other people other than yourself are going to have to execute and you're thinking kind of around that. So I kind of want to follow like what Rocky Burris is doing this year on his property to see like, okay, what was your next improvement? Okay. What won't you do? And I think, you know, even talking about your strategy layout where you're actually doing some of the birding, you know, adjacent to bedding, within bedding, you know, how you kind of manage that so you don't lose too much of the vegetation. So you have consistency in bedding. Like so that's a big part of the design philosophy that I know you employ. So I just want to know more and, you know, try to get the best techniques and strategies out of you. So, you know, some of the listeners can really kind of benefit from it.
Yeah, I'm all about it. Yeah. Anytime you want to get on here and do something, I plan on building this facility first. So I got to get that thing knocked out. Then, once it's ready, then I can jump on my own projects and traveling and doing all the stuff that we do. But I'm excited about this one. It's definitely a learning curve just having it, and it's your own home soil, you know, your own. You can witness it day by day versus, you know what should work and you know what does work, but sometimes you can't afford to do it when you need to do it and you have to let it sit for a year. So, I mean, it's kind of it's teaching me stuff every day. So it's kind of cool to do.
I appreciate it. All right, Rocky. Well, I'm going to post in this podcast, I'm going to post your picture of the buck that you just killed. So congratulations and good luck with the building. And then we'll get back on the horn soon and chat.
All right, buddy. Appreciate it.
All right, man. See you soon. Bye.
Maximize Your Hunt is a production of Whitetail Landscapes. For more information on how John Teeter and his team of experts can help you maximize your hunt, check out whitetaillandscapes.com.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.